Hello, I am Guy Hornsby and welcome to episode 3 of This Is Not Happening. A monthly chat about music with four of us, me, Joey.
Hi.
David.
Hello.
And Nolan.
Really looking forward to talking about disco later on.
Couldn't just do hello. Anyway, we'll be talking about our latest album of the month and bringing our favourite tracks to the discussion table. And this month, our album choice is a pretty different proposition to the first two we've covered. The enigmatic Eve Tumor's latest album, Heaven to a Tortured Mind, will certainly be keeping us busy, and we'll be chewing through our favourite disco cuts after that. I can feel David's pain of having to only select one already.
It was so hard. So hard.
If you haven't listened to episodes 1 and 2, then please head to thisisnothappening.buzzsprout.com or wherever you find your podcasts and search for This Is Not Happening. We certainly had a lively discussion about Jessie Ware's What's Your Pleasure and female vocalists that we love, and also went into a chat about what musically chills us out. Gents, how's Jessie sounding this month on?
I probably played it more this month than I did the month before we recorded, actually, to be honest. It's got its hooks in. I'm reaching for it. My wife's reaching for it. My kids know the words. They're dancing to it.
Right. Okay, I'll tell you how I know it's crossed over. They were using it in the Tour de France highlights montage the other day. Yep.
On Radio 2.
Tip the overground.
No, on ITV4 on the TV.
I heard it out, which I know I'm not out much at the moment, but I went to Escape to Freight Island and I heard that and it sounded frigging great.
Yeah.
So yeah, Nolan, come on, stick your spade in the mud.
I've been really enjoying the Roisin Murphy initial singles and the interviews that she's been having. I'm really looking forward to her album.
Ah, well, there's always one. Hey, but also, please catch the blog at thisisnothappening.net for all our albums of the month, plus much, much more music we talk about in between these podcast episodes. Some really great music around this month, too. So, this brings us on to the album of the month, and this month it's my choice. And without doubt, it's probably provoked the most debate and reaction we've had so far. But that is also exactly how we like it. This ain't by design, girl. Take it softer, you know. I'm out my mind, girl. Don't make this harder. Eve Tumor's a mysterious artist. There's someone whose name is even disputed, whose location's pretty much unknown outside his own circle, and makes music that's pretty hard to pin down and is as challenging it is to navigate to. His fourth album, Heaven to a Tortured Mind, is the second on the Mighty Warp imprint and is a genre-bending selection of music that never really lets a listener settle. I've certainly listened to it to a good dozen times now, and I'm still not entirely sure what to make of it. I was brought to them by a desire to steer myself away from easy options. I could have gone for something comforting that I knew I'd like Everything, but I felt I needed to search out something that I wouldn't usually settle on. And so searching around the dark corners of the internet, I was struck probably as much about their imagery as anything else. So I'm really glad I've chosen it. And while we'll come to it, certainly compared to their previous work, this is a step change again, but probably not in the direction you'd think at first listen. It's pretty impossible to pigeonhole something that feels entirely intended after I'd got into the album. You could certainly be forgiven by listening to the brilliant opening track, Gospel for a New Century, with distorted horns, booming bass, the sort of fuzzy wailing vocals. And that sounds like a great standalone single to sort of a Prince-like modern industrial sort of funk album. But that gets laid waste too quite quickly in the next 30 minutes. I mean, there's elements of funk, noise, soul music, sort of this almost screaming laments, this, you know, interspersed of little tracks that really make you have to cling on for dear life, really. You know, I listen to a lot of music and I don't think I've been as challenged listening to a music as an album as much as this. However, what I will definitely say about it is it's got me hooked. Even if it's difficult at times to listen to, I find myself really coming back to it, and it's kind of got a kind of magnetic presence that I find it's hard to ignore in an opposite of, say, something like Jessie Ware, the lovely kind of Sun's Out album. I can digest it at any point. I can't listen to this album sometimes, and that is a compliment, even if it doesn't sound like one. Yeah, so I'm definitely interested to see what everyone else's reaction is. Maybe Joey, I'll ask you to weigh in. What are your thoughts?
I mean, it's kind of where to start, I think, is as difficult as anything in talking about this album. So Eve Tumor. So yeah, I'm glad I'm kicking off here because I love this. Let's Let's cut straight to it. I absolutely love it. This really easily could have been one of my choices. I listened to this when it first came out and thought, nope, can't choose that for album of the month. And I kind of left it, to be honest. And I'm really glad you chose it. I'm really glad that we came back to it. So first off, it is a difficult listen. It's challenging. I don't think I found it anywhere near as challenging as you did. And I don't think that's because I'm cool or I'm like way more into like real music than you guys and or anything like that. I just think it's like my music growing up, let's use the word noise. When I say noise, I mean in the widest sense of noise. Like I like noisy music. I've loved Sonic Youth for decades. I love the like 7 minute feedback laden dirges of kind of just grinding noise. I went to see Sonic Youth when I was Dirty Tour 1992. How old was I? 14, 15 or something like that, the Hummingbird. And I went with two of my mates who didn't come to school for 4 days afterwards. And we called it the Sonic Plague. They were just like, they were just melted by the noise of that gig. So obviously I'm not here to talk about Sonic Youth, but that's kind of my musical heritage. And I'm kind of really comfortable with difficult noise and music. So this felt fine for me. What I did struggle with at the beginning was where do I play it? I couldn't play it when I was working. Actually, bizarrely, doesn't sound that great in the car. I stuck it on while I'm cooking with two kids in the background, my wife trying to do stuff. It's like, turn that off. Headphones is where you listen to this music. Like, yeah. This is such a headphones album. So the first few times I listened to this, I went for a walk. I've got like a 40-minute loop. What's this, like a 38-minute album or something, I think, 12 tracks? Yeah. Sub 40, 30 something minutes. I could get through this every time I went for a walk and uninterrupted and listening to it really, really importantly from start to finish all the way through. It's almost like there's tracks on there. Romanticist and Dream Palette, I thought was one track until I sat down and played it where I could actually see the tracks running through. Like Dream Palette's the track that just like starts off with like a fireworks show, like it's the only way I can describe it, and then like resolves into this like beautiful melody. So for me, like it's not as challenging. I'm kind of a little bit surprised maybe at how challenging you found it, but that's fine. That's absolutely fine. It just kind of makes me feel a little bit like a loner on this one, but I absolutely love it. I think it's got everything in it for me. I'd really like to get you guys to talk in a second, but I'm on a one-man crusade to make this not sound as challenging as it is. So when people talk about the genre switching and things like that, I kind of don't feel it. This for me is a funk soul album made by somebody with a maniacal mind. Go for it, David.
It wasn't that I found it. I think by the sounds of what we've, our responses, mine is the least positive. And I didn't find it challenging.
Go on.
I was waiting for that moment. And I mean, do you know what? You're right. It sounds shit in the car. I don't know why. It does sound shit in the car.
I quite enjoyed it in the car.
Oh, God, it's interesting.
What the fuck do I know?
it's a wave of emotions in the car. But I'll get to that. You go.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It didn't sound. And do you know what? It's interesting. I've talked to you this week about my struggles with it. And I listened to it again today, weirdly, while I was like clearing out some boxes or something. And I suddenly went, oh, this is not bad. You know, this is kind of hard. Like, I was like, oh. And
What was the track, David, that made you feel that?
I think Kerosene, I really like that track.
Kerosene is fantastic.
It's always connected with me. And as I've said to you on my blog post, like, if all the tracks are as good as Kerosene, what for me, the problem is like, the opening track is great. What's it called, the opening track? It's
Gospel to a New Country.
It's like a manifesto. It sets up the album. It says what we're going to do. And then the two fucking shittiest tracks on the album are the next two tracks. And it wastes so much goodwill and like the energy I have to spend getting through those two tracks. And look, there's loads, like it's not a long album. You don't have to, it's not hard to get through it. Actually, sometimes I've listened to it and it's over before I've realized it. But maybe, I don't know, the problem could just be me. You know, it could just be my problem.
But it's not you though. You know, what's really interesting about us doing the blog, but also doing this podcast, is that there is a week and a half, two week difference between our initial thoughts and when it sinks in. And I think that there are so many elements to this that I agree with, but actually, you know, so let me get to the elements I agree with that we haven't really touched on. So first and foremost, a lot of the reviews, and I said this on the blog, but a lot of the reviews that I've read say this is an unpolished album. It's not. It's a very polished album.
Yeah, totally.
It's a well thought out album. Everybody involved definitely knows what they're doing.
Oh, the production is unbelievably like textured and dense.
Yeah. And there's this huge element to it that, I don't know, man, maybe it's because I'm getting older, but there's a huge element. There's part of my mind saying that there's albums like this that should be getting released and people should be loving, because it's going to actually, you know, sculpt the next 5 years of albums that hit the mainstream. But I think actually drilling this down on that point and where I've got to in the last couple of weeks since I made my blog post is that, you know what, I don't think there's anything about this album that's breaking the mold. Like, I'm not saying this album isn't great, but what I'm saying is that I think it's trying to get somewhere where it's not. And the thing that I've been really struggling with is that song number two, I think the album would be a different album without that song on it. And when you're listening to this on repeat, it changes the game. And also with there's a lot of elements, and I'm on Joey's tip, right? This is the headphones album, 100%. In the car, it doesn't work so well. In the house, definitely don't play it by your family. But there are some really good strengths to it. But the more I listen to it, the harder I'm finding it to find those strengths.
Do you know what as well? I think that there's something we have talked about in the blog in the last 8 years, which is the sequencing of an album is so important. And I think about this, I think that's often, right? Imagine taking your favorite album and then turning it. Imagine if Abbey Road started with Maxwell Silver Hammer, right? I mean, fuck that.
Can I completely... So are you suggesting the track sequencing on this album is poor?
Yes.
No, I think fundamentally
the track sequencing
disagree.
On this album is absolutely immense.
Yeah, I'm with Joey here.
Minus two tracks, it's so well
thought out, and it's thought out by somebody who absolutely understands the limits of what people can sort of tolerate. And when to release pressure. I think Medicine Burn coming after Gospel for a New Century is kind of awesome. Identity Trade for me is kind of the track that I could lose, but it's a minute and 45 seconds long, or 2 minutes or something like that. It's kind of gone before you know it. And then Kerosene is only as powerful as it is because it follows what's actually a relatively uncomfortable few minutes beforehand, and it's kind of made better by what precedes it. I think the track sequencing is amazing.
If you take out Medicine Burn and Identity Trade and you make that into an album, it is a way different album for me. And I think those two songs actually wreck this album.
And also, like, I guess it's a discussion about what the noise is, and I'm really trying to respect what you're saying about like I like Sonic Youth, but I didn't love them like you did. I love Three Muses and Pixies and loads of those bands, but they're not like Sonic Youth. You know, that noise is noising. Yeah, yeah. You know, totally different thing. And maybe I've been thinking a lot through this album. Like, am I hung up on songwriting? Do I need to have a tune? Like, is it a problem for me?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, like, go on, Joe. Yeah.
What? Yeah. Yeah. No. So I was going to say before, actually, on episode one, like, it was beautiful. It was burnt into my memory. You described yourself as being a pop beast, I think, or a pop
being.
Animal or something being. Like that. Yeah, yeah, pop being, that's it. Yeah, yeah. So this is kind of a really weird proposition for you because it's got so many hooks in there. It's got so much there to love as a pop being. I kind of think Eve Do More really makes you work for it.
Yeah. That's a really good way of
putting it. I think they really keep you on your toes.
See,
I think they want you to enjoy those moments, but like pleasure kind of and pain are kind of the same thing.
No,
I mean, have you watched the videos?
I feel like what I want to do is I want them to make some decisions because that's what part of the process of being an artist. I feel like some of those songs or some of those soundscapes and some of the things that you experience, as you said, have got so many ideas. Like, for example, they're obviously an amazing guitarist. When the guitar lets rip, I'm like, it's kind of Prince-esque, you know, like it's like, I'm like, well, where the fuck has that been? I want to hear that. And then you hear it for like 10 seconds and then you're back into, I don't know, 30 other things. And it's kind of exhausting because I am struggling to navigate what their journey is, you know.
So you know what, actually, I don't have an issue with that. It's one of the things that I like about the album. I think it's versatile in that way.
Last month, we talked about like sort of what Jesse Ware was and who was it for. Who's this for then?
I have no idea. I love that.
You know what it is? Whoever they are, they're younger than us.
There's an element to that. We're in our 40s, three of us. There's so many genres that this album points to. It's not reinventing anything. But I guess to address your point on that, Nolan, that's okay, because it can't if it's trying to blend all those things together. Look, to me, I think it's absolutely fine for this to be a challenge and for this to be this kind of circuitous route that is difficult. And then I totally get you, Joey, absolutely the kind of releasing, building and releasing of pressure. I absolutely feel that with this album. But the other thing I'd say is, if we're talking about journey to get here, you think this is hard work, try listening to their previous three albums. After a couple of listens of this, I had to go through YouTube, listen to a good half of each of those, the first three albums. I mean, shit the bed. It is hard fucking work, first few. It's a different thing. There's more uniformity in the sense that the kind of noise, ambient, kind of strange, disembodied kind of style to some of it. But this, to me, feels like someone who is on a musical journey through what they now want to experiment with. And this is where they've got to. And they have made the best go of what they're doing. And it's interesting. And I love the fact that we all don't agree on it and we don't necessarily all like it. That is so much more interesting than going, oh yeah, we all think it's an absolutely wonderful piece of music.
And Guy, I fully agree with you. And what excites me about this, and I laughed, and sorry for giving you like a Cheshire Cat laugh over talking about the last couple albums, because I went down that path. Yeah. I'm sure all of us have. And for me, it wasn't a comfortable path. A love of both Joey and I is Perfume Genius. And we were there like very early on that. And it took you guys a little bit later to get into this. And my question that I was listening when I was listening to this a couple of weeks ago is this a start of something? Is it going to be more in line with what we want to do or what we want to hear?
This could be the crossover album before they go into some sort of mega stardom.
They're playing V-Fest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting that they reference, I read an interview where they referenced Throbbing Gristle as like one of their main influences. And Throbbing Gristle are one of those bands that have existed in the, like in my universe as a music fan for the entire of my adult life. And whenever I've gone near them, I've gone, nah, you're fine. and I sort of understand, you know, what they are and what the place that they live. And like, I'm really happy they exist. And the world would be a worse place if they didn't exist. And actually, music would be less left field if they didn't exist. And it's really important about where's the center of music, where's the left field of music. And so it's really important for people to make music that isn't just easy to digest. But I still feel like these thoughts aren't completely formed. Now, this is a majorly talented artist who's obviously incredibly musical, who can really do all kinds of stuff. The palette of what they're doing is amazing.
Yeah, they can write. The album shows he can write anything they like.
I think what we're trying to all decide is there's two points on this. Do we like it? But I think this is a really tough one. Is that does it deserve its place in music that some people think it does and some people thinks it doesn't? And that's what I'm struggling with.
Because I think the issue is that what some artists do is they record, they go, I'm here. Come and fucking meet me if you want. Yeah, I'm not going to move one inch. This is what I do. And the uncompromising nature of that is amazing. You know, famously, that would be the Velvet Underground, right, for example. But also, I guess it would be the Smiths. This is the world we created. You come and you get on board or you don't do that. And then obviously, Jessie wears the opposite. She's like, look at all the stuff I can do. Enjoy my lovely party. I want to be your friend. You know, like, it's absolutely the opposite. And actually, Run the Jewels are interesting because they walk that tightrope really nicely. They go, hey, we want to in your face. We want everyone to love us too a little bit. You know, there's like a little bit. That's such a great thing that they do. So I think it's interesting. Our first album was somewhere between the two. Our second one was saying, please love me. And this one was going, I don't give a fuck what you think.
Yeah, yeah. Don't love me. You don't even know where I live.
Just work this out, fuckers. You know, that's...
I genuinely don't hear that level of... I think what you just described there is kind of like artistic arrogance. It's like, yeah, I don't hear that. Really conscious of being really quiet on this one. But I almost don't get it. And I guess... the beauty of this is realizing, David, I've known you for a long time. I've always considered us to have similar musical tastes. And no. There's a Venn diagram. We've obviously got a massive overlap. The edges of our individual circles are absolutely miles apart, though. To your point, Nolan, it's like, do we like it? I mean, yeah, I like it. Does this deserve its space in music? Well, yeah, 100%. I'm not sure anybody's got the right to say that something doesn't deserve its space in music. I think if Yves Dumont was talking about like how amazing this was and how revolutionary it was, then you've got to start asking questions about it. But they're not saying that. It's everybody else that's describing it. And you can't, you shouldn't listen to something and try and prove reviewers wrong or anything like that. You've just got to try and disconnect that, surely.
Is this the confusing thing about this? So, like, I remember when MGMT came out and they kept on saying, we're going to be the greatest band ever. And you kind of went, I like the music, but these guys...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But the thing is with it, though, on your point, Joey, and you're absolutely right, is that they kind of aren't saying anything.
No.
They're releasing music, but super elusive. But they botch most of the interviews that they do on purpose. And we always base, you know, our love of music, but we read so many articles about it to try to understand an artist and where they're coming from. Jessie Ware is a great example. I didn't read up on it. And my opinion was partially changed last month on that. But the thing is, you can't read much about this artist. So it breaks down to us in our opinions. I think the cracking thing about this is that I actually don't think the artist gives a fuck what we think.
You know? Yeah, that is really, I love that. And I think it's actually really rare. You know, I think there's a really interesting flip side between the kind of sort of articles, the blogs who are like fawning over them. And absolutely from the couple of pieces I've read, you know, they don't give a shit. And that isn't an arrogance. That's just, as you say, this is what I make. I'm in total artistic control of it. I get the it can feel a bit meandering or thrown together, but I think that is absolutely intended. There's such the production is so dense in some of it. We haven't really touched on the videos. I mean, Christ, some of the videos that they release, especially from this album, that is a vision. That is, they're not fucking about. You know, there is a singular vision of how they want that to be. You don't make Gospel for a New Century. You don't make that video going, well, I sort of got an idea. Maybe I'll do a bit of a devilly thing. No, that is a realized, fully formed idea. And to me, this album will divide, but I don't think you can argue that they have this singular vision of what they want to make musically, visually, how they want to control their image, how they want to come across, what they want to give to people. And actually, in a world where it's saturated social media, everyone's on it, there's Instagram, all this shit. I love that. I've got a real respect for that as an artist. Whatever fawning bollocks you might read about it on music blogs.
Well, at the same time, that is absolutely true. And I think that's actually a brilliant point. I think we've talked actually in all three podcasts so far about the genuineness of an artist and whether they believe what they're doing. And I think we felt actually one thing all three albums have had in common is there's a sincerity about the delivery of what is happening here. This is not smoke and mirrors. This is not someone bullshitting you. Or they're not tired, they haven't run out of ideas. They're coming at you with what they've got. And I've really enjoyed that about it. But because I didn't know a lot about the artists, and one of the first things I did was I went and read a load of the reviews of the album. they are stellar. I mean, the reviews are amazing. Yeah. They set me up for something that sounded more revolutionary than the album does. Because at particularly the first few times I listened to it, I was like, well, this is TV on the Radio and Ariel Pink, right? You know, this is like...
Why do none of the reviews mention TV on the Radio?
I don't know. It's so weird. It's so like TV on the Radio.
Like how, like a murder. How is that not picked up?
It's so, yeah, so weird.
I kind of do see your point actually about like the way that it's been described as revolutionary. Yep. I genuinely don't think it is. I think it's a funk soul album that
made with a rock heart.
You know, made by different. Somebody with a post punk love of rock.
Yeah, like TV on the Radio.
Yeah, yeah, and who likes to keep people on their toes and take the piss out of them a little bit, I think.
No, Pitchfork is the worst because you can smell them. I feel like sometimes when they're reviewing something, they're thinking, I don't know what this is. I'm scared. I need to praise it because it might be the future. And, yeah. You know, like, guys,
I've written about music for 20 years. I can smell bullshit because I've written it. And I can smell bullshit there. And it's just a bit like, stop trying so hard. This is a singular vision and a different album to a lot of what I've listened to. But it isn't the White Album. And that's okay.
Joey. Let's change the conversation a little bit. And let's make it a little bit more singular. Favorite tracks?
I know what David's is.
It's Kerosene. It's the best track on the album by miles.
Can I just say, though... Who else heard the female vocal and thought a little bit of Sinead O'Connor in a very good way?
Oh, God, yes.
That's a good call.
Yes, totally.
I was like, I really like it for that reason. There's like a lot of pain in that. And I was like, oh, my God, yeah.
So for me, Strawberry Privilege is my most consistent. You know, it's one of those that the rest of them kind of dip in and out for me, but that is my favorite. No matter where I am on repeat, after that it's Dream Palette and maybe Romanticus.
Just one.
As ever, Nolan, just the one.
Just to underline the point, Strawberry Privilege, is that the best name of a track?
Yeah, it's a great.
It's a very Prince name, isn't it? As well,
because Strawberry's in it. I mean,
right.
Can I say something while we're on a Prince tip? I feel like they've got a Prince within them, and you can hear it coming out. The thing I like about the album the least, and I find the most frustrating, is the Prince rears its head now and again, and you hear
Superstars, right?
Totally.
Superstars is my track of the album.
But... Okay, great. And the odd guitar solo, a little moment, and then it gets shoved back in the box, and the noise core begins again.
Oh, I quite like that though. It's a real awesome, like they're tickling your balls. I love that.
All the things that you've said.
We're not all into that, Guy.
All I've wanted to say is. But you say that like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, totally.
like I could have just said, but you say that like it's a bad thing to everything. Like, I love the fact
that
they can do that and then stick Prince back in his box or whatever.
So Strawberry Privilege for you, David. No, Kerosene for you, David.
Yeah.
Strawberry Privilege, Nolan. Joey, you were...
Superstars.
I'm going to be a really boring and just say the track that wakes me up in the middle of the night is Gospel for a New Century.
That's good.
It's so weird that my first impression of it is so powerful. It's such a great, great opening. Like, I have a thing about opening tracks on albums as well.
Yeah.
And it's completely changed in the context of the whole album. And definitely, Joey, you've got to listen to the whole album. For me, I feel like I'm 100%. Selling it short when I only get halfway through. It's the most accessible record on there, but it's so good.
Oh, I don't think it is the most accessible. I think it's the most impactful.
Do you remember
in 2015, I picked an album called Wild Heart by Miguel. And I know it's the Prince influence here as well, but that soul funk drive coming through it, I got loads of Miguel from that. I went back, listened to Miguel, and then went back into this. And I was hearing pieces switch between the two. Stick it back on, listen to it again, David. I remembered you loved that album.
I love that album. But I do feel like this is Miguel. If it was playing in the other room and someone had a blender on in the room that you were in.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
A little bit like you, Joey. We definitely said, you've got to be really careful not to just go, and this sounds like this, and this sounds like this. Because what you're saying then is you're almost kind of going, oh, well, they listen to a load of music, and then they go, well, I'm going to make a track like Prince. That's not what I'm saying. But what I found that was fascinating about this album as well is there are little bits of little songs where I'm suddenly like smacked in the chops of this song. Like, there's a feedback bit that sounds like Fitter Happier by Radiohead, where it's kind of dropping through the scales. There's a bit of a weird chord sequence that made me think of Moses Sumney, of all people.
You know, and Joey picked that album a couple of years ago. I got that same influence. I think that the tough
there's
thing is...
There's amazing melodies hidden in there that...
But I think the difference between the Moses album and this album is that the more you listen to the Moses album a couple of years in and other albums that we've referenced here today and on the blog, is that the more you listen to them, the better they get. I'm going to say it, the more you listen to this, I don't think the better it gets.
I'm afraid I agree. The Moses album opens like a flower and then you'll find opposite. Yourself.
I am completely switched. I totally get what you're saying, David. But I think what I'm enjoying about this album is those little sonic Easter egg, these nuggets. Like, there's bits that I think that kind of, that whole detuned vocal that makes me think, wow, that felt like a Young Fathers record.
Oh, that's a good reference.
Yeah.
That's
a and then there were bits of Ghost Poet. You know, there's a load of reference points. Yeah, I find that there's this little shards of light hitting me, and I'm like, wow, this is suddenly think of something that I never thought I'd think of. That's what I find interesting about it.
You know, we were talking about when you've had the discussion and how it always informs what you think yourself, and I think that the thing I'm taking away right now is it does work as an album. It is an album. It's a complete experience. I mean, I don't like the order of some of the tracks, and I do struggle. I think it starts with that great song, and then I lose my way with it. But there are nuggets in it, and there are at least three or four songs I really engage with, and I feel like I'm listening to somebody's artistic vision. I think the other thing is that what we're forgetting, we're talking about listening to music at different ages and stuff. We are dealing now with a generation of artists, and it's funny you mentioned MGMT, because I think the one thing MGMT have got in common with you two more is they're a post-Spotify, post-iTunes artist who will have grown up listening to everything. Yeah. Like everything, you would just devour everything. The idea of the musical barriers that we grew up in, where you literally, the clothes you wore, you were an indie kid, you were a hip-hop kid, you were like, you walk down the street and everyone knows what you are. Well, no one gives a shit about that stuff now because you listen to all of it. And I can see that on my teenage daughter. Like, it's like...
She hasn't got a gladiola in her top pocket.
She has not got a gladiola in her top pocket. But the point is like... Like, actually, it's probably very natural to live in a space where people aren't going, oh, what's this? Because it's everything. Because you listen to everything. You know, that's what it is now. Now, the hardest part of that is making a coherent story out of that noise.
And again, this isn't some kind of like muso brag or anything, but I think I've always liked things that are on the edges. They're kind of the hazy space between genres. When I was working through all the disco tracks that we're going to do, it's the edges of disco that I like. It's not the core. It's not the periphery. And if I look at kind of guitar music, it's not that core sort of indie bit. It's the peripheral noisy bit. So for me, again, I'll kind of finish where I started. This felt pretty natural for me. Mm. I love it. Yeah. I think they're a bizarre musical monster genius.
This discussion could go on for a year, and I don't think we'd agree on it, and that is why I think we wrote the blog in the first place. So if at least this comes across, then yeah, I love agreeing to disagree. But yeah, Eve Tumor's Heaven to a Tortured Mind is an album that is going to provoke people for a long time, and that's great. I'm so glad I picked it.
If you're listening and you have thoughts on this, respond to us on the blog. Like,
absolutely,
that's what we thrive on. We're four guys with opinions. But we want everybody's opinions because we're going to be talking to our friends. This is what this is all about.
So this brings us to the second half of the podcast each time. And we all bring a track that is maybe a genre, a feeling, something we talked about and teed up last time. And actually, we talked a lot about disco in reference to Jesse Ware's album. So we thought we'd each bring a track that we felt was disco to us. And disco is... immensely huge genre I think, you know, we could deep dive into this another time, and hey, who knows, we might well end up doing a disco episode all of its own. I know David particularly like that. We're just going to talk about a track we've siphoned out. We each brought a track to here that means disco to us. Let's start with Joey.
First of all, I found this process so enthralling and exciting. Yeah. I've absolutely loved the 6,000 hours I've put into Cheat.
David's jealous now.
So, my introduction to this track.
This is how good disco is.
Thank you, David. So, my introduction to this track has got to come through an introduction to the record label that it was born from. So, like, the whole theory here for me is that disco wasn't always about, like, glitter balls and exclusive clubs. Disco kind of was, in some instances, born on the streets. And in this instance, in Harlem and from P&P Records. There's loads of theories about what P&P stood for. Poor People with Potential is my favourite, even though that's actually three P's. So if you follow the theory that hip-hop was a reaction to those disenfranchised by disco's dominance, P&P is kind of the anomalous counterpoint to that argument. They specialised in like low-funk, scuzzy soul tunes. And in the 80s, actually ended up putting out a load of hip-hop tracks, like by Spoonie G, for instance. Now, in terms of their kind of disco output, Cloud One as an artist stick out for me like a sore thumb. Just absolutely awesome. Disco Juice is like the track that everybody knows. Norman Cook sampled, etc. But I couldn't look past this track, Atmosphere Strut. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's like 9 minutes of the most ridiculous synth you've ever heard. Awesome vocal hooks and a groove for me that is absolutely insatiable. I know it's my choice, but I literally haven't stopped listening to this 9 minutes for the last month. It's awesome.
Pick that one out. I loved it. I don't think we're going to get a hell of a lot of dissent here over those four tracks, but I loved it. As you say, 9 minutes, that groove, that classic sort of melody vocal partnership where the phrasing goes up on the vocal as it does with the bass or the lead. I love that. It's a classic disco motif. That kind of, there's bits of sort of whoops and cheers that kind of remind me of the What's Going On intro.
It's beautiful, that, isn't it?
Brilliant.
And there's kind of 2 minutes of it, bang in the middle. It's
xylophones, it's congas, guitar licks, there's a wobbly synth in there, there's hand clap.
Yeah.
And what
you like crack.
And what's great about everything we've chosen is, I think what we've understand disco is like, you get a riff and then you hit the riff. And then you build a riff, and then you play with a riff, and then you break down the riff, and then you build up the riff again, and then, you know, and like...
You can see David's face.
Oh, like, no, but like, rock music is really interesting. Sometimes I feel like rock music is almost working on a more basic level, when it goes, ooh, we've got a bridge and a chorus, and you're like, that's nothing. Oh, well done. You've got like two different sections. You had four chords and you threw another one in.
It's Tom Moulton is laughing at rock music.
Yeah. Like disco goes, yeah, well, we've just got a xylophone and drums now. And now we've put in some crazy horns. And that, you know, that, my God. I mean, this track does all that.
There's so much in there, isn't it?
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Yeah. It's you can feel the era in the track as well.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, all
real drums.
What year is it formed?
You know, 1976, so it's relatively early. Tracks. I thought you'd be surprised by that, David. It's early, isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah.
God, it is early. Oh, that's even better. That feels even more pure. Like it's just, I mean, oh, you can just feel the string vests and the flipping sweat. I mean, it's just so good. Yeah, yeah. That's great.
Awesome.
I love it.
It's by far, actually, by a couple of years, the earliest track that of these four is.
Yeah, that's great.
It's great. It's a beautiful, beautiful record. And it just, unfortunately, now more than ever, it just makes me want to go and dance my balls off in a disco till 6 in the morning in an embarrassing dad way. And I can't, and it's frustrating.
So we've got a key question then.
Yeah.
Spin it or bin it?
I think the bin's going to be an empty place tonight. I want to spin this all night.
I feel like...
Yeah, it for me.
Yeah, I mean, we might need to spin it and then have a super spin. For like,
what's a super spin like?
We'll find
just
out.
Just some shit David invented.
We're not sure yet.
Like,
yeah, no, it's a great tune. I'm spinning the hell out of this. Yeah,
well, probably brings you your track then, David, which is it's probably the one that's outside the mold for all the rest of us, right? So good. Fantastic man.
Yeah, as you know, I've been also doing this sort of side project, this sort of radio show of sort of foreign language pop music, and listening to lots of music from around the world, including a lot of African music. And I've come across this artist a long time ago, but he's really fascinating. He's called William Onayabor. He was a Nigerian musician. What I love about him, I mean, God, his life story is amazing.
It's amazing, yeah.
He ended up studying cinematography in Russia, returning to Nigeria in the 1970s to set up his own music label. He was later crowned a high chief, where he lived as a businessman working on government contracts. He became West African Industrialist of the Year in 1987. We're not dealing with any old guy here, right? Luakabop, which is David Byrne's record label that does world music compilations and stuff, basically featured him on a compilation. I think he made a load of albums between the late 70s and early 80s. And he was really popular in Nigeria, like, and I think because of his success of as a well-known industrialist, he had the money to buy loads of keyboards. So now, when you see him, he wears a cowboy hat all the time. Yeah. He looks like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, but one guy. He's got like five keyboards. But my God, he could play. So he made a load of records. And then by the time the West discovered him, kind of, in the early, or I guess the 2010s, he was a born-again Christian and he renounced his music career. They had to track him down and persuade him. It took him 5 years to persuade him to release a compilation of his music, which they did in 2013. And then he died in 2017. But, at least I think he'd realised that the world had begun to know how great he was. Now, I thought, like we all did, I had such an enormous long list of songs I wanted to play. But I looked at the definition of disco. I don't remember quite what it said, but it was sort of basically the idea that music was there to make you dance. It was rhythm. It was built on a rhythm, and it was repetitive, and it might took you on a journey, and its main purpose was to make you dance. I got a couple of friends who were really into William Onayabor, and they play this track at parties, and everybody absolutely loves it.
It's impossible to sit still.
And people who've never heard it before, that's the real thing. And then they just dance to it. And that's why I chose it.
I think it's a great track. I think it's got the whole kind of Afro disco thing, which is like a genre in itself that, especially over the last couple of years, has got more and more light to it that highlights this whole kind of movement that was there that nobody knew about, that is totally, actually some of the most incredible music, and there's so many influences that came out of that genre that I wouldn't say is better, but it's just as good.
It's this like amazing self-contained complete, it's like the country scene out in Lagos actually as well. There's a massive, there's this bubble that had this incredible disco scene in it that literally, well, it was the 70s, so no one's going to fly to Lagos because they thought, oh, I've heard there's a guy making disco records. It's this amazing offshoot of disco, all of its own, that is incredibly danceable and completely idiosyncratic and of its own little furrow, that is like this goldmine of discovery. Like Soundway Records does some amazing stuff these days as well. And it's so danceable. Like I listened to put when I've listened to this over the last few days, I walked down the street listening to it on a little coffee break from work. I imagine it's the closing credits of my own little film, and I've got some people in seats to be next to me, and I'm doing a little boogie, and I'm dressed in some stupid shit. This is my, roll credits. Do-do-do, fantastic man. It's like so good.
Well, we'd all want to be that fantastic man.
You can't not smile. Yeah. It isn't no, really
I want to watch that. That sounds cool. Oh,
he also understands the thing we're saying all the time, which is like, disco is a journey. It's like 6.5 minutes long. And he's got the confidence to go, yeah, we're going to have a little synth break.
So I kind of got lost in a bit of a wormhole with his music, really, to be honest. And I thank you for that. So Atomic Bomb was a track that I had on a kind of best tracks of the year playlist from, I think it was 2014 when the Who Is album was released.
Yeah.
And I kind of loved it. And I kind of wish I'd picked up on that a little bit more and explored it a little bit more. I saw it pop up when you chose it. And I thought, oh, is this the track that I remember? And it wasn't. But I kind of like, if you pick it apart, you can almost hear like an old Trojan roots reggae track in there a little bit as well. there's that kind of shuffly rhythm in there, but then it builds and it's, I just think it's beautiful. It's incredible.
It's absolutely superb. I haven't heard a track of his that is anything other than great, that makes me feel happy. And what's wrong with that?
Yeah, totally.
So I kind of annoyed that I didn't just dive in when it came out.
So spin it or bin it?
Spin it.
Spin it.
Why? How can you spin this? You're dead on the inside if you don't spin this.
I mean, seriously. Yeah.
That brings you on to you, Nolan. Another absolute banger.
There's two elements other than I think it sounds really good. And the first element is that it came out in 1979, but it started charting in 1980. That's the year I was born. And he's also from Canada. The only reason I know this is one of my really good mates, Lindsay Brown, bought me the album for my birthday, for my 40th this year. Fuck, I didn't know that. I really like the record, bro. I really like it. I mean, Gino had a couple of good tracks, amazing tracks, actually, that I have always played out in my disco sets and in my funkin' hip hop and disco sets. And this is one of them. I just think that when you kind of think about like encompassing everything about disco and the glam era, but a bit of funk and a bit of what it contributed to hip hop, it brings it all in. It's got that thriving bass, but it's kind of a bit cheesy, you know, with that bum 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 bum, and it's got the drums just as I like it, and then as it builds, the female vocals coming in, and it builds, and the pianos. For me, it encompasses everything that disco should be. It's feel good. It's got some soul, and that's what you want.
And it's called Dancer.
And it's also called like Dancer, which is type.
No, hang on. It's called Dancer. And it's by Gino Socio. If you had to invent a fictitious disco artist, yeah, in your head, and a song by them, you would call it Dancer by Gino Socio.
Are you despairing all the Italian Canadians in the
Nolan,
1970s
Nolan,
in Toronto, Ontario?
Nolan, I'm saying I'm so upset that I haven't heard this song before. Like, it is unbelievable. That I genuinely, when I was listening to it, of all the tracks that we chose, it was the one, and you know, Guy, you've alluded to this a lot, we're all missing being out with our friends or playing a set for friends or being in a club or whatever else, or this is the one track I heard and I thought, oh my God, if I had that in my record box and I pulled it out and I stuck it on, it would blow the house up. Actually, and kudos to you, because I don't think, like, it's really hard to pull this off. I was trying to find the perfect disco song that did all the stuff. You did it. You found that song. I just really hope that's his real name, because it's so good.
I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer, but I'm rolling with it. And I'm sure he's been doing that for the last 30 years.
I just hope he's not a guy called Dave who's into ice hockey. But
whoa, hold on. He's called Gino. He's from Toronto or maybe Montreal. He's definitely into ice hockey.
Okay.
But I hope he's not called Dave, because that would ruin it.
No. Anyway.
Yes, let's leave it at that. Now, this is a great record. Like, am I the only one that got a little bit of Yellow the Race out of this? But I think also when you talk about disco, if you think, oh, this sounds like invariably the disco track is the one that preceded the track that you're thinking of, the originator of so many of these things. But yeah, this was...
And actually, loads of those early disco house, disco or disco tracks or electro tracks in the 80s, you know, lifted this stuff massively.
Yeah, illegally.
Totally, but like, and the Italians were so involved in that stuff. And what I loved about what they were doing was they were not thinking, is this cool or is it naff? They were like, will people dance to it? And, you know, I think sometimes Anglo-American culture is obsessed with cool, and Italians don't give a shit about that stuff. It does play into me. Like, I love Italo house. I love 80s kind of Italo stuff. Like,
yeah. Daniele Baldelli is like...
Yeah, totally. Alessandro Robotnik, all that kind of stuff. And it's just like, you know, it just is like, I'm going to do my thing and you're going to love it because you're going to dance.
Is it a little bit cold?
Ooh.
I don't think so. I mean, it's, it makes me want to dance. All these ones do.
Yeah, it does make me want to dance. So there's two of these four tracks. Right, okay, so Spin It or Bin It, for all four of them, I'm spinning all of them. I do love them all. Two of them leave me a little bit colder. And I made a point before when I was when we were talking about Eve 2 more about, like, I kind of naturally move away from the periphery of a genre into the kind of the outskirts and where they overlap with other genres.
I know where this is going.
so the Cloud One for me and Fantastic Man kind of are at the outskirts of disco. Right.
Yeah.
And particularly with Cloud One being 76, it's way more in that kind of that soul era, but it's got so many of those early disco vibes. The reason I don't like classic hit in the center of periphery of disco is because some of it leaves me feeling a little bit cold, I'm lacking the emotion. I love this track. I get everything that everyone's just said. For me, it's not quite warm enough to really, really smash it home for me.
Don't you think, I think that delivering something incredible and magnificent right in the middle of a movement that expresses exactly what it is maybe harder than anything else?
So Gino Socio, we're all spinning that, right?
Spin it.
Oh, God, yes.
I'm spinning it twice. I guess it brings me to my one. And I get what you're saying, Joey, about maybe the edges. I appreciate your edges of music. And I went right round the houses. I listened to two entire top 100 disco record things in 1 week. I listened to like 12 hours of disco or something stupid. And landed on this track because I could have gone in any different sort of number of places. But this has everything that is disco to me in it. And yes, some of it's cliches, but Hooked on You by Suron from his seventh album. Jesus, how many did he do? In 1980. I really wanted to go South Soul, but this guy was such an incredible producer. And obviously everyone wants to say Supernature is the biggest track he did. But this has got everything. Jocelyn Brown vocal, a really brilliant female chorus line, this kind of incredible walking bass line that breaks into these horns. Like there's like a whole record before the vocal comes in. It's like a whole disco 7-inch before the vocal even comes in.
every time I listen to this track, I forget there's vocals in it. Yeah, so your point then about like there's a whole disco 7-inch.
It's like 3 minutes of like this is a great disco really instrumental, like, and then you're like,
oh, wow, there's a load of vocals as well.
Everybody is trying for the maximum.
Right, the Venn diagram of music, right? Disco, experimental music, no vocals for 3 minutes, yeah? Mm-hmm. That's, right, rock, forget it. No. Maybe a minute, maybe two.
Well, we had prog rock by this point.
Well, yeah, but nobody really liked prog rock.
I hadn't heard this before. Mr. Disco, had you heard this, David?
I think I had heard it, yeah, but it is, I mean, it's phenomenal. It's
the production is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's really good.
You know what, a little dive on this was, I loved this. He co-produced, one, Jocelyn Brown was uncredited on this record because it's 1980. And secondly, he produced this with a guy called Raymond Donnez, who was a massive French producer who worked with Rod Temperton.
Now, it's interesting you say Jocelyn Brown was uncredited because the weird thing about disco is that the people who got credited on the records is very strange. It's not like a rock band or something where you know who the personnel were. And particularly with like guest female vocalists, so many people did work that didn't get credited properly. Oh, yeah. Or there's a band name, but it's not really a name. Sometimes they made it up in the studio. A record label got a producer together with a vocalist and they stuck them in a studio and then they called them whatever. And they put, because the idea at the time, the mystique of the 12 inch and you didn't know who it was and you didn't, you know, it had the label on. That was part of the fun, right? You know, you didn't know who it was. But of course, what it meant was loads and loads of amazing musicians did loads of incredible work that which they barely got credit for. Yeah. And that was the downside of disco, you know, and particularly for you know, black female vocalists doing incredible kind of soul vocals on those sort of disco tracks. Sometimes they weren't even getting the credit for what they did, you know.
I think the great thing that came from that, though, is that I know this song from going to the Southport Weekender, which Defected had a massive influence in, and it's a proper anthem. I mean, that vocal is an anthem. When I listened to this, I knew it from going to Southport. So as much as there are so many parts of disco in the history and the labels and the vocals that have gone missing, there are a handful of people, Simon Dunmore,
Dave Lee,
because obviously he's changed his name recently or dropped the Joey Negro. But the thing is with it is that there's a lot of people that have dug out these vocals and, you know, and have really tried to expose them. And a lot of that came from house music, which is great. And I think that's the beautiful thing. You know, Joey said it in our WhatsApp group that, you know, he was surprised about how much disco is within everything that we do. And 100%, you know, there was a movement at the time. There's three movements, in my opinion. There was punk, there was disco, and there was hip hop. And they actually really all feed into each other. Two survived initially more than the other. But the third one is actually you listen to the radio. You listen, you know, we talked about Jesse Ware last month. That third column is the biggest thing in music right now, in my opinion.
But, you know, it's just interesting talking about disco vocalists and the credit people get for what they do. And I was thinking about the death of Denise Johnson, you know, who's a legendary Mancunian singer who sang on so many people's records. And particularly, actually, I think there's been a little bit of chat about how little Primal Scream have credited her for her work on Screamadelica. Now, I'm of the view that Primal Scream are the most overrated band of that entire era. They were a fey indie band. I remember back from the C86 days, they were lucky enough to come across two people, Andy Weatherall
and Denise. And Ecstasy.
And Ecstasy. And those three things made them what they are. I mean, Bobby Gillespie can barely hold a tune. You know, he's not a great vocalist. Now, you know, I'm not knocking him as a band, but when you listen to that album, you are listening to an album made by Andy Weatherall and the vocals of Denise, and they didn't even acknowledge her death. They may have done belatedly, but it's interesting to see what musicians hold other people up. And I just wanted to mention that because it came to my mind right now.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Yeah, and disco is lit. Well, look, music in general is full of stories of female artists, especially artists of color, who have been a footnote in making music, but disco especially.
And if you look at the way soul music is kind of structured, like the backing vocalists often carry the hook and the tune, and they're like
Luther Vandross and Young Americans, you know,
it's just littered with uncredited brilliance.
So are we spinning this?
oh, it's great, it's fantastic.
I'm spinning it.
We're spinning all of them. We're spinning.
What
all
a set these. This is going to be! A four track set of bangers.
I love that though. I'm looking at my playlist now. Four tracks, 30 minutes. That's how long four tracks.
Yeah. Do we even want to try and choose a favorite just for sheer belligerence? Fantastic Man, because it makes me feel I want to dance to all of them, but Fantastic Man makes me want to walk down the street and high five people. I don't need that right now.
Assuming that I can't choose my own track,
nope.
Then it pains me to say I'm going to have to A, agree with you, and B, choose David's track.
Ball Power.
You'd be unsurprised to learn I'm all about the genius Sochi. It's the most perfect disco track, and I'm so excited. I never heard it before. It's just brilliant. Thank you, Nolan.
You've given David an absolute gift there, Nolan.
Merry Christmas.
He's going to now tell everyone that he discovered it.
Definitely didn't. I mean, that's... and I think you know, with this, it is about discovering stuff. And we could have, you know, we joked about in the last podcast of stuff that we could say for disco tracks. You know, I'm with everybody else. I think Fantastic Man. If we drill down to it, is it the Gino track of classic disco? Probably not. But actually, it takes all the elements... You know, I love about disco, and it was within that era, and it's an interpretation that that if I actually drill it down, it's the stuff that I love from that era the most. You know, it's this different take on what someone heard on the radio and they went at it. And that's why I love that song so much.
Oh, well, God, near unanimity, apart from that David can't tune his own record. Look at that. So we're pretty much at the end of that episode 3 of This Is Not Happening. All the tracks you've heard in the last hour or so and all other useful links and info will be on the episode detail on the podcast. We'll be back in October with Salt Untitled, brackets, Black Ears, close brackets, or however you want to pronounce it. If you want to give us a review, you can head to ratethispodcast.com/thisisnothappening. And otherwise, until the next time, enjoy the podcast, tell your friends, tell your mum, tell your boss. Maybe don't tell your boss. And head to the blog if you want to join in with us, thisisnothappening.net. Until the next time, you've been listening to This Is Not Happening.